Welcome to Die Hard on a Blank, the podcast where we explore the influence of Die Hard on action cinema, one action movie at a time. I'm Philip Gawthorne, and with me as always is Liam Billingham, and today's film is Under Siege 2, : Dark Territory.
It's Die Hard on a train.
Second time on a train.
Can't say the quality levels match up.
It's not quite at the narrow margin, unstoppable, runaway train.
Well, you just gave like three great movies
of quality.
Quickly rank those three movies.
Oof. Unstoppable number one.
Okay.
Narrow margin number two, and runaway train number three.
Yeah, I think that's
all great though.
Now, where would the film we're talking about today, Under Siege 2: Dark Territory, fit on that list?
Somewhere at the bottom of the ocean. And then buried forever
in some kind
of nuclear waste. No, look, why should the listeners listen to us talk about this movie that frankly ain't the best?
I would say that, look, I always try to find something positive in the movies that we talk about on this show. And I would say that this is not the best, maybe the worst movie we've talked about.
It's not a very good movie. It's not. But stick with us, because there is something
very good about
this film. Well, one individual in particular that we've been very excited
Steven
to talk about.
Steven Seagal. No, it's Eric Bogosian.
It's the Eric Bogosian Appreciation Hour.
With your hosts, Liam Billingham and Phil Gawthorne.
We've been excited to talk about this movie purely for that reason. There is a lot of interesting stuff in it. But let's get into it. So Under Siege 2 was released by Warner Brothers in the U.S. on July 15th, 1995. 2 months after our last film, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Very quickly.
Was May 19th.
I know the day that I saw Under Siege 2.
I was going to ask. Sorry, I jumped ahead. Did you?
July 15th, 1995.
Because Bill Billingham was a big Seagal guy.
Well, no, not even a big Seagal guy. Big Under Siege guy.
Okay.
Like, loved Under Siege.
Okay.
So we didn't see Under Siege in the theater, but we saw two Seagal movies in the theater, like opening night or opening weekend. Unfortunately, these were post Under Siege, so it was the dark times. It was Under Siege 2 and On Deadly Ground,
which actually has a connection to this movie beyond the obvious.
Oh, I'm curious to see what that is.
Yeah,
actually, I don't know if I am. So both kind of both stinkers as far as movies go,
dude.
But
Andrew Davis ain't in the his. It is rough trucking.
Well, it's interesting you say that. But please continue the.
This film was directed by Jeff Murphy, who also did Free Jack.
Free Jack,
which
a
I
movie
love.
That we recently expressed some enthusiasm about on a different podcast.
That's
which
right.
We'll pimp.
We'll talk about that.
At the end of the
Liam's cancelled. Show's over. Yeah. Bye. Thanks,
Bye,
guys.
Thank
it's been
you so
fun.
Much. I regret nothing.
Jeff Murphy has, he's made a movie that we're fond of, and this features a familiar character actor from that movie, Jonathan Banks.
There are things to appreciate about this movie.
There are some more than others. So this film stars Steven Seagal, Eric Bogosian, Katherine Heigl, Morris Chestnut, and Everett McGill. It was written by Richard Hatem and Matt Reeves.
Matt Reeves of the Batman fame.
Indeed. Based on characters created by J.F. Lawton in the first film, on an estimated budget of $60 million. Where was that? On the screen.
The satellite.
The stock footage. Yeah. Like, that was some expensive stock footage. Yet, it grossed $104 million. It was a decent hit.
Do you remember how much Under Siege made?
I'd have to pull that. Under Siege, I recall being about a $35 million budget and being well over $100 million gross. It was monster. So this didn't do the same kind of business. But again, we talked about how in those days, the metric was like 65% was considered successful. Now things are very different. But it actually was in this era, as you just alluded to, like Seagal was popular.
Mm. This was kind of his heyday.
Yeah. And, you know, this was an important property, and it's a Warner Brothers movie. It's a big studio movie.
With, like, weirdly at times very high production value, and then other times, like, what's going on in the frame? Like, there's some really high-quality stuff, and then there's some, like, cheap stuff. And we can, I'm thinking of a couple things specifically. But before we get there, will you tell us a little bit about our diehard DNA?
I'd love to. So this is, of course, a classic diehard on a blank scenario. Bad guys take over a train, up to one guy to stop them, yada, yada. You know the deal by now.
We got it.
It's a direct sequel to Under Siege, of course, one of the earliest and best diehard on a blank movies. Now, there was a Philly special in here.
Bing, 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 bing.
Dual helicopter insertion sequence. You
I'm doing
know
the helicopter
I love that.
Sound. Yeah.
See also Predator.
You can see Phil's soul leaving his body when this happens.
Although in this one, it wasn't quite, it doesn't have, isn't, you know, it hasn't got the Predator magic or the diehard, you know, Century City, like, you know.
Well,
that,
you know,
that
we were getting getting stuffed with these movies so regularly that I feel like maybe there's like a potential hint of like fatigue with the kind of concept at this point.
Yeah.
Maybe like a little. No, that's not to say it's not a good concept. Of course, we based a podcast on it. But like, you know, it's a little bit like he's on a train this time.
It's a little like a photocopy of a photocopy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it sort of got a little diluted. And it just, it doesn't have a lot of, it feels very much like, look, let's just get this product in theaters.
Yes.
Not like, hey, like a director who's coming in who's really excited about doing something interesting and exciting. But the problem, you know, working with Seagal in this era was just like, you know, such a difficult endeavor, right? He's just so, and he's a producer
on these
movies, and not just a producer, like a full-on above the title producer, not like a producer. Like even Bruce Willis isn't a credited producer on the Die Hard movies, even though it all orbits around him, and he effectively is a producer, but Seagal actually is. So imagine dealing with, you know, that, you know, all of that. So a couple of other things that I caught in terms of Die Hard DNA. Naked couple being interrupted mid-coitus by the arrival of
the
terrorists.
One of the few laugh-out-loud lines in this movie is, it's called an orgasm, which is, like, quite funny. Quite funny. Quite stupid, but quite funny.
We also had a bad guy demanding an important code immediately upon arrival.
Mm-hmm.
Computer hacking being integral to the villain's plan. Blonde angel of death henchman.
That's Everett McGill.
And hero making IEDs out of available materials. And a final Mexican standoff where the leading lady is held hostage by the bad guy. So, you know, a lot of diehard DNA, as you would
There's
expect.
There's also the, like, familial strife between Steven Seagal
Good
and Catherine
point,
Heigl, which, like, I wouldn't have clocked when I saw this film in 1995. I don't know if I've watched this film in its entirety since 1995 when it came out. It's almost 30 years old.
Wow.
That's crazy. But
Where is the Steelbook? 30th anniversary, Under Siege 2.
So, very quick shout out to prep for this episode. I did try to rent this at No Free Ads, but Be Kind Video in Burbank, and they only had the first one on DVD. But they did help me out with the other movie I watched to prep.
Just to say, like, on my personal history of this, because in my enthusiasm to talk about this, I jumped over it. But when I, you know, I went to university and studied film, and a bunch of my friends.
Your specific area was Steven Seagal studies, if I remember.
That's right. Yeah, I that was what my dissertation was on.
Your first class was squinting angrily,
muttering monosyllables.
How to comb your hair back, dress in black, and be a little wooden.
That basically taught me everything I need to know, but
about podcasts,
about life, if anything. But me and my boys, who are all film, you know, film students, Keith, Adam, Marcus, you know, the whole squad
the
of
whole
us
gang.
Would have these quote bad movie nights,
right?
Where we would, you know, watch something like this. And kind of, you know, have a few tinnies, have a few cans, have a laugh. And this was one of those movies. And it's actually not that fun,
no,
sadly.
It's not.
On that level
of
like,
a
yeah, even on the level of just like a no brainer, like let's, you know, crack some cans and just have a laugh and watch bad guys get killed in some one liners. It's pretty tough stuff.
Well, I think that's a good segue into our section on Anatomy of an Action Movie, which we'll cover right after this break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're back.
We're back with the next section of the show, Anatomy of an Action Movie, where we explore the tenets.
We have tickets to see Tenet.
Yay! We're going.
We're going. Re-release.
It's our Woodstock.
I was there, man. Woodstock. No,
Tenet.
Tenet
was re-released.
Yeah, it was amazing.
We're going.
We're going to see Tenet. We're very excited. There are no friends at dusk, but there are friends at the movie theater when we see Tenet.
Yeah.
I want to meet the people who they're my people that show up for Tenet in IMAX.
Yes,
and like we're seeing it at maybe the best place in the entire country.
Yeah,
to see
pretty.
It too.
It's pretty exciting.
Very exciting.
So that's our usual Tenet.
So we'll
bit.
Be talking about that for months. That's going to sort of be the
look
the,
forward to that.
Yeah, exactly. You guys excited?
All right, so the first tenet of Anatomy of an Action Movie is the premise. And the premise for Under Siege 2 is thus. While traveling from Denver to L.A. via train with his estranged niece Sarah, Katherine Heigl, ex-Navy SEAL Casey Ryback, Steven Seagal, finds himself in the middle of a terrorist takeover led by disgruntled computer genius Travis Dane, Eric Bogosian, who plans to use his experimental government satellite weapon to launch a massive attack on the Eastern Seaboard. And the ticking clock is that Dane plans to blow up the Pentagon and apparently the nuclear reactor that's underneath it in 45 minutes unless his demands are met.
I don't mean to snarf, but just the idea that there's a nuclear reactor.
I just love
the
that
Pentagon.
They just throw it in, yeah. You know, like, and this, of course, leads to the government sending in stealth bombers to destroy the train once its location is discovered, putting Ryback between a rock and a hard place, or between the Rockies and dark territory.
I'm leaving. I'm out of here. Phil had fun with this synopsis.
Now, the premise isn't bad, right?
No.
I think the idea of a satellite that can cause earthquakes, that's cool. That's pretty original and interesting. And as you were just saying, I think there's some good dialogue in the movie. You know, Matt Reeves is a writer on this movie. The story moves along briskly. Some of his talent shines through. But my biggest thought was that a passenger train is actually like a bad setting for a movie of this kind because it feels claustrophobic and cramped, but not in a good way. It feels like it limits and restricts the possibilities with the action, whereas in Narrow Margin, it works because it's more of a suspense thriller that's
it's
like
a cat and mouse
cat
movie.
And mouse,
yeah,
right?
Narrow Margin's a cat and mouse movie. I also would say that one thing that is effective about the original is that it feels like it could potentially happen in real life, whereas this one has this experimental satellite that can cause earthquakes that feels
almost
just
a bit
like,
science fiction-y.
Yeah, it's like they abandoned any pretense of reality. And look, I'm not going to these. I have like a bit somewhat puritanical relationship to action movies, and I want them to be. This is after me saying I love Tenet, but I want them to be in like a realistic world, and I think that's just like preposterous to an nth degree,
yeah.
And I think that hurts it. But I agree with you. The train, like it also doesn't feel like they use the expanse of the train all that effectively. It feels like it kind of takes place in like four cars.
Yeah,
which you know, only in retrospect that I realized that. But you're right. It moves briskly. It's entertaining. I think the biggest problem with this movie is, unfortunately, the man at its center.
Well, yes. I mean. And to your point about that, yes, there's not enough room to swing a cat on the train. And also, it's a visually flat environment. The train itself isn't interesting, as in, unstoppable, right? Where the train is almost like becomes like a character in its own right. You know, it's been talked of as if it's a monster movie to some extent, right? But even the costumes are all dark. Everything's earth tones. It's dull aesthetically. And the dull one-dimensional acting from the man at its center really doesn't help when you already have those things working against it. So we'll move on to our section about the hero. So Steven Seagal is back as Casey Ryback. What are the differences between him and John McClane in your mind?
Well, I think...
What makes him distinct as a character?
I don't think he... the unfortunate thing is that I think is what makes him distinct is the fact that he's kind of dour and, like, not all that dimensional and, like, whether it's him or it's how he's directed, which it could be a combination of the two. I think Andrew Davis got some things out of him in Under Siege. Like when there's that moment that we talked about in that episode, which you can go back and listen to, and which Andrew Davis approved of. He listened to it, which is amazing.
The King
I'll never
of Chicago.
Get over it.
We love him.
Andrew Davis forever. This is an Andrew Davis podcast. He has that scene where Seagal says, like, he doesn't like guns. And, like, it really works in that movie. Like, you kind of believe him as this guy who's, like, had to be violent professionally, and, like, that's his... But it's not who he is, and he's a cook. And, like, look, it's not Hamlet, but it's not bad.
It's not?
Oh, no. Oh, no, guys.
Well, actually...
To be or not to be.
Jeff Murphy said that the underlying melody of Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, is, in fact...
Hamlet.
I
mean, John McTiernan said, get off my block. Only I can say that. Yeah. It's not Hamlet, but it works. I think the problem with this movie is that, and, you know, I don't know the man, but this is well documented. The ego of the lead of this movie gets in the way of the ability for him to create a human performance. And, like, he's very condescending to everyone in this movie. Yeah. Like, Morris Chestnut.
Especially to Morris Chestnut.
Who is, like, pretty charming, but very annoying. This role is very annoying.
Yeah.
He's, like, condescending to him. Like,
he's almost a bully. He's a bully.
There's
he's a
moment,
bully to him.
There's a moment where he's like, you got shot. And Steven Seagal's like, this isn't getting shot. And it's like, what is your deal? Like, why are you? And it just feels like, again, producer status. Like, he can't. It's like that rumor that The Rock can't lose a fight. It's like, it feels like Seagal can't always. Can't,
well,
has
he
to
never
be cool.
seems fazed by anything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, which makes it hard to care. Whereas John McClane, you know, certainly in the first movie, you know, his feet are cut to ribbons.
Right.
His wife, he feels he's going to die. He feels he's going to die with things left horribly with his wife. And you really feel for the humanity and the vulnerability of the character. Whereas this guy doesn't even break a sweat. Even when two trains collide, leading to a huge explosion.
Like,
he sort of lightly jogs. Like, you know, no sense of urgency.
You guys can't see it, but I'm running in a Charlie Chaplin-esque way.
Yeah, there's no sort of sense of desperation or anything.
To draw a parallel to the John McClane, something that came up in our episode with Chris Tilly. Hi, Chris. Hope you're listening. I know you love Under Siege, too. But in our episode on Dark of Vengeance is that, like, one thing that people struggle with in that movie, and I totally understand this, is, like, if there was a bomb in a school, McClane probably would be looking for the bomb and not necessarily, like, chasing Simon down. And what that might say about an issue with the movie that, like, I still think it rocks, it does tell you about how, like, McClane's humanity, McClane is about people, and despite his kind of, like, cynicism and kind of, like, blowhardedness, he is, like, we've talked about from the beginning, like, he cares about people and he wants to protect hostages. And, like, there's, like, a moment in this movie where Seagal's like, I don't want anything to happen to the hostages. And I'm like, do you care? I can't tell that you care. You don't have, like... You just don't. You don't seem to like.
Well, you know what's
people,
crazy,
and it's not like at his core, he's like a hero with a heart of gold. He's not a hero with a heart of gold character, which McClane kind of
he's
is.
He's a hero with a heart of stone, almost.
Right?
Just
he's
so stoic that it's just so hard to be, like. It feels like the actor has subsumed the character in the first
and not
movie.
Not in a fun way.
Not in a fun way. No.
Right.
In an egomaniacal way.
Right.
In the first movie, as you said, he actually does have moments of charm and levity and dimension, but in this one, it just feels like Seagal, this is my persona, this is my brand, I'm perfect, I know everything.
And Jeff Murphy's like he's a competent, good filmmaker, but, like, I don't know that he has the, like, ability to restrain Andrew Davis in his performance.
You need a strong hand.
Yeah, Andrew Davis was able to sort of restrain Seagal and find things in him, and he's a great actor. He's particularly a great director of, like, historically stoic actors. Like, he got things out of...
Chuck Norris, right?
I don't think that movie's amazing, but, it, you know, he gets things out of people. He gets Harrison Ford to do vulnerable things that he'd only really done in, like, Witness. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he really found room in his performances and his directing of actors to create sympathy for characters. And I just don't think that that comes through here. And it might have something to do with Andrew Davis, but I think it more... has to do with the egomaniacal nature of its star and, like, main producer.
Yeah, yeah. I actually found Seagal so unlikable in this iteration that I found myself rooting for Travis Dane to succeed and being slightly annoyed when Ryback screws things up, right? Because it was just a way more charismatic, interesting, compelling, you know, riveting actor that was like... I'm interested in this guy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in Travis Dane. I could care less about... This guy's just like a black hole of charisma. It's just sucking any light into him. And, you know, the movie is just like... It's all being dissipated, you know, so...
Feels like a good moment to pivot our conversation to our villain. Villains, because I actually think it's both worthwhile talking about our other villain, but... Let's start with. Should we start with Travis Dane, or should we start with Everett McGill as a character whose name I forget?
Yeah, well, we can talk about Everett McGill briefly, and then I think we'll get into the meat of this.
I think Everett McGill is very good in this movie. This is his second time on the podcast.
Yep,
he was in License to Kill. He's sort of the Mr. Joshua Carl. In this configuration, he's the brute force against the sort of like more methodical villain. Though, I can't wait to talk about Bogosian. I think Everett McGill is great. I think, you know, there's this really weird moment that I want to talk about very briefly where Katherine Heigl sticks her fingernail into his cheek. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
She really holds it there. And he's like sexually aroused by it.
Right.
And I got to say, like, it's gross. But it's gross in, like, a way that I wish the rest of the movie had a little bit of, like...
It's that Twin Peaks-y, creepiness.
Well, again, he's a big David Lynch actor.
Well, yeah, it's like a little bit of that weird... It needs more weirdness. It needs more color, more flavor,
more subversive.
Odd, eccentric choices.
Yeah, and that... Right? It's, like, weird. If they did that now, people would be like, whoa, that's gross. But, like, it weirdly... Like, when she sprays him with the pepper spray and he takes it, like, he's great and, like, totally like the badass angel of death kind of figure. And I like, he's kind of a weird combo because he almost is a little bit more like Stranix and Tommy Lee Jones. Cause there's that weird moment when they're like, I know you in Under Siege.
Oh, that was that was a great cigar.
Oh, thanks. Wow.
You nailed that.
Wow, cool. We serve the same master.
Wow.
Sick. But like, yeah, I just turn off any emotion or feeling. I do the exact opposite
of
me.
Can you do Seagal doing Hamlet? Because I feel like...
Seems, madam. Nay, I know not seems. You don't remember that?
Wow, there we go.
I
thought you were
going to
do this more an obvious speech, but you went to a deep cut.
Let's see what I got.
For the Hamlet heads.
What's a good Hamlet line? I'm not doing the obvious one. No, I have to do the obvious
one.
Just
do it. Okay. Give the people what they want.
The play's the thing. Just kidding. Okay. To be or not to be, that's the question. Pretty good.
Amazing. Yeah. Nailed it. There you go. That's our show.
So let's turn the recording off and let's just rewrite our Hamlet pitch. Steven Seagal is Hamlet.
Seagal is... Hamlet.
Hey, Claudius. So much better.
Love it.
I think McGill is very good.
He's really good.
He makes unconventional choices. He's menacing, and he's a great contrast to Bogosian as Travis Dane.
Yes.
So that brings us...
to the moment you've all been waiting for. We've been hyping this kind of since
the
show began.
Of...
With hence the hashtag Eric Bogosian Forever.
Forever.
That
forever
is trending, I believe, as of today.
So, as of today. Yeah, we brought him back. I did a little bit of prep. I watched talk radio. I read a little bit of Drinking in America. And I was going to watch Suburbia, but I ran out of time. But I love Eric Bogosian. I love him. I think
what's your relationship with him? Like, how far back does
it go? For I mean, really, it probably started when I saw this movie, and then like he was on Law and Order, and I've always just been a fan of. I have a soft spot for American theater raconteurs. You know, like Sam. We talked about this in the last episode. My son Samuel is partially named after Samuel Jackson, but also partially named after Sam Shepard, mm-hmm. the great American mm-hmm. playwright and actor. And I guess what I love about a guy like Eric Bogosian, he's managed to create this really interesting career. And I think guys like that, you know, for folks that don't know, he was a playwright, but before that, a monologuist who moved to New York City in like the 80s and like was kind of got sober at like 28, mm. which is early 30s, and like kind of lived this New York City life and put on plays at Joe Papp's Public Theater. And if you know Joe Papp, he really wanted to bring theater to the people. He's in this era when like people, and I don't think this really happens anymore, when theater was engaged with in a larger cultural sense, and a guy like Bogosian could write a play or write a one-man show, and Oliver Stone would turn it into this movie that's, like, pretty interesting to watch. And he also, like, you know, he starred on Law & Order. He was a screen doctor, script doctor, for a long time. And he now, you know, he's in Uncut Gems, which is a really interesting thing to talk about. He's on Succession. He sort of plays the Bernie Sanders character. And what I love about him is that to me, he sort of represents this like lineage of, again, like a John Cassavetes.
Yes.
Or a, to some extent, Ben Gazzara as an actor. He's mm-hmm. a journeyman who's done everything and feels like he's lived hard. And so I just admire him. I think guys like those are sort of kind of like my like art dads, like the guys who really, and I didn't like necessarily, I read his plays in college. I read Suburbia. I think it's like a precondition to going to American drama school. You have to read Suburbia. Also, I should say, from Massachusetts, yes. Armenian-American from Massachusetts. So like reading a play like Suburbia, though I grew up in a different kind of not less, he grew up much more in a, or more, slightly more urban environment, you know, Woburn, Massachusetts, where my father-in-law was from, much closer to Boston than I was. But he's sort of got at the like, to be generic or cliche about the kind of like sick rot and dysfunction in a play like Suburbia and American culture. And I'll shut up in a second, but I revisited Talk Radio and I found that I was more impressed by it because I think when I was younger and read it and saw it, I viewed Bogosian as a truth teller. Like, I viewed him closer to the character that he plays in that film, Barry Champlain, who's based on a shock jock guy who was murdered by neo-Nazis. But I found that Bogosian is as interested in exploring, like, shitty, toxic maleness in that movie and in that script as much as he is in being a guy who, like, wants to take down every aspect of American society through, like, being verbally witty. And I just think he's a fascinating artist and like the kind that's hard to get made anymore.
He's an icon, right? And he, you know, he's a Renaissance man as
Thank you. That's the best way to say
like,
it.
Like across so many different, a true artist, a true, you know, a man of the theater, right?
Right.
You know, and so I remember seeing Talk Radio, I think when I was a kid, and it's one of those kind of weird late night movies you stumble on, and it's perfect as a late night movie because it's like a, it's like an 11 o'clock movie. The whole movie kind of takes place in the witching hour,
right?
Like wherever all the crazies are coming out the woodwork and calling in, and you know, it has that kind of like dangerous energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing it and being captivated by it and being captivated by him when I was too young to really understand the themes.
That's
of the
other
movie.
Thing is you get you know, intrigued by these people at an age when you don't really understand what they're about, you know?
But he is so captivating as an actor that you cannot take your eyes off him.
He kind of jumps off the screen.
He really does. He has that Pacino, like young Pacino had that quality of the intensity of the eyes. You know, he's very interesting to look at visually.
Mm-hmm.
And he just has this magnetism that is so compelling. So he was on my radar as, you know, as, and also I think think it's so cool when it was like he was a playwright and an actor. He created that character, but he also wrote the character as a one-man play, right? When Talk Radio was on Broadway. It was actually revived by Liev Schreiber, right?
Yeah.
And they became friends. Did you really?
Great.
How was it? What was the difference?
I mean, you know, Liev Schreiber, I would say, is like a more internal kind of... I mean, that's not true. I think he did a great job, and I thought the production was really, really good. But I, like, never... I was still like, it's Eric Bogosian, you know,
not
at all a criticism of Liev Schreiber. He's an astonishing actor, and it's a play, so anyone can do it.
Right.
That's the beauty of theater, right? But you know, my time in New York was always spent thinking about, even though I naively thinking about like how cool it would have been to be there when Bogosian was around. Of course, everyone was a fucking junkie, and like I don't think it was that great in the same sense.
Well, it's romanticized retrospectively,
and that's what moved a lot of people to New York from like 1990 to 2015. Was like, I want to be there when like the Public Theater was this entity, which it still is, but it's a different institution, as any institution would be many years on. But yeah, he represents this kind of like thoughtful but rock and roll
punk
American
maleness. Like it's almost like art punk or art house punk.
Yeah.
You know, because the punk scene was on the rise when he was moving to New York, right, which was huge at that time with the famous clubs.
Yeah. And she hung out at, did drugs at.
Right. And he was around that scene and, you know, it's all performance art. He hates that term, performance art, but, you know, a performer.
Right.
You know, they just put a group of like wild and crazy artists.
And I think, you know,
he was part of that scene.
A big point, there's like three sort of things that he's done in the last few years that I think are a really interesting reflection. So when you look back, the classical image of him is like, plays the shock jock, writes like a play called Drinking in America, Suburbia, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And he's kind of this like self-destructive force who's making these plays up and like living in New York and like living hard. And then something interesting, I think, has happened to him. The first is that he did a interview with Marc Maron, which is great.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
It's a long episode.
I did too.
It's fantastic.
And he is very self-reflective about who he was in that time. He's like, I was kind of a blowhard. I thought I knew everything. And I'm not like, you know, and now as a much older man with kids, I like know that I was like kind of full of shit. It's sort of his words, right? He's kind of like, he was making art, but in his own words, he sort of like thought he knew more than he did, which is really interesting because I actually think there's a self-awareness in the writing of Talk Radio that this guy is kind of as self-destructive and full of shit as any of the people calling him on the phone.
Yes.
So I really appreciate that. He was on there to promote a book called Operation Nemesis, which is about the murder of high-ranking Turkish officials after the Armenian genocide. It's a little bit like, it's compared to Munich, the story of the Israeli operatives, the Mossad operatives who took out the architects of the Munich massacre. But I read Operation Nemesis after this episode came out, and it reads in like 3 days. It is an amazing book with a final chapter that really gets into like the psyche and the way everything in Turkey changed after in response to what happened in Armenia and kind of like the way this whole genocide was suppressed. And it is an amazing book. And what really intrigues me about it is that it's him reckoning with his like ethnic Armenian identity while writing this like, I mean, it should be an action movie. It is fucking incredible. And like, I literally read it in 3 days. I couldn't put it down. I thought it was astonishing.
I wanted to ask you about, because we talked about this off mic and how much you love this book. And again, it speaks to him being a Renaissance man, right? That this is a historical book.
Yeah.
Right? Even though it reads like an action thriller, but
he's a historian.
It's
very dense in details. Yeah, he turned himself into essentially a historian.
Which is incredible. But I was curious as to whether, you know, with Munich, one of the things I think the brilliance of that film is that the final, if there is a point to be made, it seems like it's reached a point of the destructive cycle of revenge ultimately achieves nothing.
Yeah, the futility
of... just perpetrates war and horror, right?
If you cut off the head of the snake, it grows back.
That seemed to be the point of Munich, and I thought it was very, very sensitive and thoughtful in how that film ended. I'm curious as to whether... is it just like laying out the facts, or do you feel like he is... is there any kind of
political
statement, or does he just sort of say this is what happened and it was justified, or does he condemn it, or is it just laying out the facts and it's for the reader to decide?
Risk of like oversimplifying these things, because like it is tough to compare them, and whenever you're talking about genocide or these kinds of issues, like it's tough to talk about.
Of course.
However, one thing that is interesting about this book is that the term was kind of coined to describe this event, which was the murder of Armenians in Turkey by the Turkish government. And he lays out the facts in this really rip-roaring way. And any sort of, I think, Armenian, and I'm not Armenian, but from what I understand, any sort of Armenian person writing about the Turkish genocide, the Armenian genocide, excuse me, is writing about the fact that it is vehemently denied by the Turkish government and by largely the Turkish citizenship. A lot of Turkish people, not all, don't believe that it didn't happen or that it's grossly exaggerated. And so the final chapter of the book goes into how exactly the propaganda machine in Turkey convinced people it never happened. So he's not writing about the futility of revenge, though I do think he gets into kind of like, what's so fascinating is that it was run out of Massachusetts.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. He talked about
Watertown, Massachusetts, which is very Armenian, and I've spent some time there. So they're getting revenge. It doesn't quite achieve that level of like, oh my goodness, like the futility of revenge, it doesn't do anything. But what it does get into is how propaganda perpetrated by the state can convince you that something didn't happen and remake a society. And that's what's really chilling in the book. And what I remember, I mean, because I read the book 10 years ago, but I remember, and I thought about revisiting it, just to revisit it. But what's so chilling about the book is this final chapter that he lays out, like this is how the Turkish government laid out this story so that they were able to convince people it didn't happen. And it's a very controversial topic in Turkey. I know I have had Turkish colleagues who lived in New York, very progressive, who struggled with it, who would say things like, I don't think it happened the way that it's described. And it just goes to show, look, this is a complex topic, but I think it goes to show you that like the power of governments and media and, you know, various actors to kind of complicate narratives. The book really gets at that, and it's amazing.
What I think is so great about that, I mean, you know, we'll move on because, you know, we're not doing a political show, but I think this is important to talk about in the concept of, you know, historicizing things is important. Without that, you know, that's where propaganda can grow.
Right.
Without facts, without actually documenting.
And this is really fact-driven.
So he's you're really doing a service to the world.
Yeah.
And to his community, his people, his ethnicity, by documenting this story that does have, like, misconceptions around it or whatever. So it's like, it just speaks to what a kind of a hero this guy is.
Well, and committed to something bigger than himself.
Yes. It's so admirable.
And
right.
I think what's that sort of segues interestingly into, he's spent the past few years as an actor doing these really interesting roles. He was on Succession playing a sort of Bernie Sanders-like figure, and he's very good. He's only in a few episodes. But I'm so intrigued, and I think it's genius, how the Safdie brothers use him in Uncut Gems. So one thing that's really interesting, we've barely talked about him in this movie.
I have a theory about that
Is that Eric Bogosian is traditionally thought of as like vaguely ethnic. He's played a lot of, he's not a Jew, he's an Armenian. He's played a lot of Jews. He's done this kind of, these roles where he's kind of like the ethnic guy. And in Uncut Gems, he plays Adam Sandler's cousin, and he's Adam Sandler owes him money and he's trying to get money from him. And what's so amazing is that, like, he's as much sympathetic to Adam Sandler's sort of disease of gambling and, like, not being able to live a normal life. And I think it's such a great choice to take Boghossian, who's historically played these, like, shitty, toxic dudes, and have him play a guy that's, like, survived to this point in his life. Like, it really, and he's looking at someone doing the. If this movie were made 30 years ago, there's a solid chance Eric Boghossian would be up for the role. And to see him play the kind of, like, wizened older figure looking back with, like, equal parts anger and pity, the looks he administers in this movie, the looks he gives Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems, especially towards the end, if you've seen the film and you know what happens, are, like, devastating. I've seen the film 3 or 4 times, and every time I'm like, Jesus Christ, Eric Boghossian should have been, like, nominated for an Academy Award for this movie.
My theory about it as well to this point is that I think the Safdie brothers are huge fans of talk radio because it's a similar, there's a type of movie
that's like a slice of
a man's life summarizing the totality of his life,
yeah.
Which is what Uncut Gems is, right?
Yeah.
Which is what talk radio is, which is what, like, a movie I really like called What Just Happened with Robert De Niro.
I like What Just Happened.
Or Falling Down. It's basically like takes a compressed time frame of a man's life, a Lock, that Tom Hardy movie,
yeah, which I love.
Like,
I love
kind of like
yeah.
that, right?
Yeah.
It's like he's having an affair, he's trying to hold his marriage together, he's trying to solve a massive work crisis, he's having an existential meltdown.
Yeah.
All of these kind of things get compressed in a time frame, and it sort of summarizes the measure of a man to some extent, right? And I think that's sort of what Uncut Gems is about, and that's why Boghossian's in there, because I think
that's
they're
good.
Huge talk radio fans. Just to cap all this off, I mean, so basically, he was on my radar after talk radio, and then I'd see him pop up in movies like Gossip. I thought he was so cool in that as, like, the communications lecturer.
Right.
It was a very 90s movie, but I remember, like, he really popped in that. And a movie I really love called Wonderland. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but...
Who else is in that?
So it's basically the true story of John Holmes that was done as a sort of... Roman
right.
Aklef in Boogie Nights, right?
Right.
This is the true story. Val Kilmer plays John Holmes of the Wonderland Murders. So John Holmes, you know, famous porn star, got mixed up in drugs and guns and craziness. And Eric Boghossian is basically the real version of the character that Alfred Molina plays as this psychotic gangster called Eddie Nash.
Wow.
And he is absolutely terrifying in this movie as this
God
psychotic
bless.
Gangster. That movie also features a astonishing performance from Josh Lucas as a crazy heroin dealer, totally against type.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah, huge Boghossian head. And also shout out to his website, 100monologues.com, which has a collection of incredible actors like Michael
Ethan
Shannon.
Hawk.
I watched it. The one I loved was with Stephen Lang as like a sort of torture instructor for like a CIA type group. And it's really, really chilling. The matter of fact
he's
nature of it.
He's such a visceral writer. And like, he does politics without like stating politics. He's just something like that. Like he gives you this character as opposed to like someone talking.
It's just amazing. And so he in this movie.
Very, yeah.
Let's get back on track.
So,
get it?
I think it's, let's get into dark territory. What's so great in this movie is that
we
love a train pun. We're dads. We go watch trains after we finish recording. He's paranoid, he's anxious, he overreacts, and he's like terrified of being hurt physically. And like, he's just so like, in this movie. It's such a nice contrast. He's kind of a coward in a weird way.
And
I think he leans into that really. He leans into his strength.
He offers something pretty different for a diehard
Absolutely.
On a blank villain.
Yeah,
right?
Everett McGill takes care of the bruising.
Right.
And he's like kind of nervous.
He just brings this, skittery, sweaty, nervous, like cowardly, egotistical energy. All of that, like Barry, it's like Barry Champlain takes over the train.
Yeah, totally.
You know, to some extent, with all of the complexity and dimension that comes with that.
And he's not a mustache twirling villain. He's interesting.
Yeah, he's really interesting. I did want to, you know, the gooning in this film is pretty high quality because not
there
only
is
there's Everett McGill, but there's also
Peter Green
as Mercenary One, as he's credited.
Is that what he's credited?
It's just kind of wild
Poor
for
Peter
an actor
Green.
Of his stature.
Especially at this time. He's done The Mask
and
Pulp
Fiction
to.
And
yeah.
Usual Suspects around this time. And Jonathan Banks as Scotty, who I love as my favorite terrorist here because of his choice to take the train driver's hat. That's like a 19th century.
That's a good choice.
Train driver. Shades of Chuffy for any Armstrong and Miller fans out there.
You just completely lost me, but that's fine. I think my favorite. I have to give it to Travis Dane. I know that's a choice, but Bogosian really makes an impression in this movie, and like you know, it's interesting to hear him talk on the Mark Maron podcast. He's kind of like, yeah, I did the Seagal movie. This was like a high mark for him in Hollywood. I'm sure he got paid well for this.
Deal. It's a big deal. It's a big paw.
It's an inspired choice to
Warner
cast.
Warner Brothers, big sequel, $60 billion budget.
Inspired choice to cast him.
Yeah. And it's by far the most interesting part of the film. The action, moving on to that section, the action's kind of largely forgettable. It was such an interesting idea with the satellite that can cause earthquakes, but we never really see it used properly or effectively. And in fact, going back to the point I was making earlier, when they do, there's a moment where they attack China, and it's a particularly egregious moment because it uses this really clumsy dissolve. It's basically Kurtwood Smith and all the sort of generals.
Great.
We love him, and I have a point about him later. All the generals, you know, that in the Pentagon, whatever, watching things unfold, and it just dissolves to what actually was unused footage from Seagal's previous film, On Deadly Ground, that they just dissolve in to show this, like, the China attack, instead of showing anything cool or even just satellite imagery of something.
You know what weirdly
weird and crazy happening?
You know what it weirdly made me think of, and then we can move on, is Black Hat.
Yes.
Like, weirdly, the terror attack, or the
stuff at the beginning
of Black Hat, which in the director's cut is...
Is that a nuclear power station?
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Right?
But it's like, I mean, this movie is not Black Hat. I would say the best action moment in this entire movie is the moment when Seagal is attached to the line that's on the train and Everett McGill shoots it off. And he's coming up, he's being pulled up by the train that's in locomotion. And he grabs the edge. I think that's a really inspired moment and like great action movie shit. But besides that, it's largely forgettable. I do like when he lights the guy on fire with the bomb.
Uh-huh.
But besides that, it's kind of like, what is this?
It's cheap-looking VFX, poor quality back projection. The whole thing just feels kind of slapdash and shoddy. And it really has the energy of a guy on set shrugging and saying, I don't know, will this do?
Yeah, that's
like,
fair.
Do you know what I mean? It has that kind of like,
get me off this fucking set. Unacceptable in an action movie.
Get me away from this guy and let's just get this in theaters and get like the calculus of the budget.
I want my money, please.
Like it has that kind of, you know.
I have Seagal, I have money, please?
I need to edit as well. It's just like, just get it out. It just feels like, just get this edited.
I feel like they cut about 10 or 15 minutes. There's a moment where he's like in the train car, and then it cuts to the villains for about 10 seconds, and then he's outside the train, hanging onto the side of it. You're like, that something happened in the middle that they cut out.
It's a mess. Let's move on. Let's take the train to the Oscars.
Let's put on our entirely ugly black suits that we're wearing to get on the train.
And let's do the Action Movie Awards.
Let's do it.
So the first award is the John McClane Yippee-ki-yay Award for Best Line. I think five here. Chance favors the prepared mind, which was Dane's credo. That's kind of interesting. Someone's been shot. Where? Here. Bang!
Yeah,
that's Jonathan Banks getting his one good moment. Of course, he was in Free Jack.
Right.
With
good movie.
Jeff Murphy's previous film.
Jeff Movies.
Jeff
that's
Movies, previous
name.
Murphy.
Directed by Jeff Movie.
I like this one. This is Bogosian. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your captor speaking.
Yeah, that's
a little
good.
Bit of play on words there. Yeah, a little bit of wacky wordplay.
See, there's some good stuff here.
And then, of course, I love this one. Get me the president, which is in the first movie as well. Admiral Bates. And this almost felt like a Bogosian improv, or this has to be a Matt Reeves line. You go get your throat ripped out. I've got 8 million people to kill and $1 billion to pick up. I mean, that's some good villainy.
That's some good villainy. I'm going to go with someone's been shot, the Jonathan Banks line.
It's very Robert Patrick in Die Hard 2.
Yes. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Have you seen this boy?
The real heads know.
Yeah, that's true.
The Hans Gruber Master Thief Award for stealing the film. Or should we even bother?
Eric Bogosian. Move on.
Let's move on. Morris Chestnut and Catherine Heigl and Everett McGill all nominated, but let's be real.
Eric Bogosian.
It's Bogosian by country mile. The Dick Thornburg Award for Dick of the Movie. Two nominees, chain-smoking CIA scumbag Tom Breaker, who's back with even more greasy hair. and Casey Ryback, especially for the way he treats Morris Chestnut in those early scenes.
I'm going to give it to Tom Breaker because he sucks so hard in this movie.
He's like, he's next
no
level
offense
sleaze.
To him. I do like that the movie hates the CIA. Yeah. That I can get on board with.
Yeah, it's definitely deeply suspicious of government and military-industrial complex. Best death.
No more table. Next time you have a chance to kill someone, don't hesitate.
Wow. I love it. Seagal awesome. As Marco. Right? Your Seagal is on point.
Like, thank you. Thank
props.
You.
Props.
Thank you. I'm moving to Russia.
The bad guy going under the train.
That's it.
Was pretty good. The bad guy getting shot by a flare. Jonathan Banks dying when the two trains collide, and Bobby throwing hot henchwoman Fatima out of the helicopter. We do like a hot henchwoman on this show. We've got a great one coming up next week with Goldeneye.
Oh, we do.
One of the all-timers.
I'm going to go with the guy going under the train because that's brutal shit.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break, but then we'll come back with a special Seagal-themed edition of the Double Jeopardy Trivia Quiz. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
All right, we're back with the Double Jeopardy Trivia Quiz where the scores can really change. Question number one. Let's just dive in.
Let's do it.
Actor Peter Green, who is well known to audiences for his work in films like Pulp Fiction, The Usual Suspects, and The Mask, appears here as Mercenary One. But in which 1993 Die Hard on a Blank style urban thriller does he appear as a thug named Sykes?
Judgment Night?
Yeah.
Whoa! Holy shit!
Nice!
I don't know how I got that. Great.
Die Hard in a Bad Neighborhood.
I like that movie.
All right, well done. Question number two. This isn't the first time that the specific train in this film has appeared in a major motion picture. In which critically acclaimed 1985 action movie did this very same locomotive also appear?
Call Al. Is it Runaway Train?
Yes,
okay,
it is.
Okay, great, great, great. Wow.
Yeah, you don't even need the clues. Mm. All right, here we go. Convoluted Corner!
Corner! Oh my God, are we radio DJs?
Okay, Los Angeles, here we go with this. Let's talk about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce until our eyeballs melt. Question number three. Legendary character actor Kurtwood Smith appears in Under Siege 2 as Air Force General Stanley Cooper. The next year, Smith would appear as the Secretary of Defense in a stylish action film that also dealt with a major crisis involving the U.S. Air Force, where stealth bombers again feature prominently.
Executive Decision. Okay, a call out.
Can you name that film?
Sorry.
You want to call out? Okay. All right, we're calling out. We're phoning a friend.
Have I seen this movie?
You have.
Okay.
It's a very simple clue. The film was directed by John Woo.
Oh, Broken Arrow. Oh, he isn't. He's the one that says we've got ourselves a Broken Arrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Arrow. Damn it.
And that's one of the most thrilling trailer moments. But,
all right.
You did pretty well.
I have one for you.
Oh, great. You're putting me in the hot seat.
Brenda Bakke plays Captain Linda. I don't remember her last name in this movie.
Yeah.
In what 1995 film did Brenda play a Hollywood legend? Ooh.
A 95 film. I couldn't really recognize
her. Sorry, 1997.
She played a Hollywood legend in a 1997 film.
Would you like to call out?
I would.
The film was directed by a director of a previous film on Die Hard on a Blank.
Hmm.
That director's name is Curtis Hanson.
Okay.
Hollywood legend.
Okay. LA Confidential.
Yeah, she plays Lana Turner.
Of course. Yeah,
she's great in it. She's got one scene, but she's very, very good. There's that great Kevin Spacey. She is Lana Turner. And Guy Pearce is like, oh, it's really, really
throws
good.
Throws a drink in his face.
Yeah. It's a good one.
That's a good one.
Because I was looking at her, I was like, I recognize this person. She's good.
That about
Under
does
Siege
it.
Two.
That
Look
about
that.
Does it.
Bing, bang, bang, boom. Eric Bogosian
We're
forever.
In and out.
Read Operation Nemesis. Watch Uncut Gems if you haven't. I think Uncut Gems is a masterpiece.
Check out 100monologues.com for more of his work. There's like a bunch of incredible
and
actors.
His WTF
doing
with Marc Maron
is
a special one. I think that's a really good
episode. And Wonderland as well. Like, I highly recommend that film. Highly underrated movie.
You know what film you should also check out is Paul Verhoeven's Total Recall. Because by the time this comes out, we should have guested on an episode of Eye of the Duck with our pals Adam Volerich and Dom Nero, where we talked about that movie extensively and our love for it. And Eye of the Duck is a really good show.
We love it. They're doing a cyberpunk season.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Started with Blade Runner. They're just done Tron. And, you know, if the episode on Total Recall is not out now, then it should be out within the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks!
I can't get him to stop doing that. By the way, very, 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 very quickly, I need to just, Jesus, it is like the radio hour in here right now. I want to just quickly share, we did a poll on Twitter where we talked about what is your favorite Die Hard sequel? And
it kind of blew up.
Yeah. Got a lot of votes. The clear winner with 72% of the vote was Die Hard with a Vengeance. Die Hard 2, Die Harder got 24% of the vote. Live Free or Die Hard got 2%, and some joker voted for a good day to die hard. Jai Courtney was on our poll and he gave it 1.3%. But what's interesting is some of the reshares of it. One person said Run Lola Run, which I think is just a funny thing to say, but I do love that movie, and that's kind of like a frenzied bank heist movie, so that's interesting. And then there was a couple. Scott Mendelson, who's a writer at Puck, writes about the box office a lot, reshared our poll and said 16 Blocks, which I think is a really cool one. And Sean O'Connell...
We're going to do it.
And Sean O'Connell, who is writing a book about Bruce Willis, retweeted and said, I will go to my grave defending Die Hard 2. And listen, Die Hard 2 rules.
It doesn't need defending.
Yeah, it doesn't need defending.
We love it. I love it.
Even someone was like, who voted for A Good Day to Die Hard? You know what? Like the movies you like.
Just all enjoy. All welcome. All opinions
enjoy
are
yourself.
Welcome.
It's fine. You know, it's not... You're wrong, but it's fine. At Diehard OAB on Twitter, at Liam G. Billingham on Twitter. Phil, are you... Now, you've been working pretty closely with the people at X on your tweets, right?
Yeah.
You know, first there was Grok, now there's Phil. There's going to be a Phil
AI. I don't know what's going on. I throw stuff out there. Sometimes, you know, I plant seeds. Sometimes they grow. I'm also back on American English Soccer, if that's your thing, as well. So I'm on that podcast talking
like
about the English Premier League.
Sorry. It looks like we'll be guesting on a lot of pods in the near future. So
yeah,
we'll update you as
some nice invitations. Some great shows.
Next time on
Keep watching the skies for Eric Bogosian's earthquake-causing satellite thing.
Next time on the show... GoldenEye.
Big one.
For England, Phil.
Oh, this, I don't know why that really, like, does, like,
you know,
find that quite emotional.
I just want to let everyone know that there's going to be a lot of German New Wave director Fassbinder chat on that because of a very specific actor who's in the film. So if you haven't watched your Fassbinder films, get to work, because we're going to be talking about that. Phil isn't ready, but
James Bond is rebooted and is back with Pierce Brosnan as 007 in GoldenEye.
Love this movie.
Join us in the next edition of Die Hard on a Blank.
We'll be back next time with Zanya Zangrava on a top. Die Hard on a Blank is a podcast created and hosted by Philip Gawthorne. Liam Billingham co-hosts and produces the show. Mike Mayer and Michael Sugar are the executive producers. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at DieHardOAB. Rate, review, follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Most importantly, tell your movie podcast-loving friends about Die Hard on a Blank. Special thanks to Suki Chu. See you next time on Die Hard on a Blank.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.